I met up with a friend recently who was feeling somewhat stressed, tired, and despondent. "I'm 3 days behind on my life," she told me. "What does that mean?" I asked her. "I need 3 more days," she said. 3 clear days to catch up with myself. "But the problem is, I can't find those 3 days. "I know that feeling," I told her. No, you don't understand." She said, "At the start of the year, I was already 3 days behind on my life. Now, fast forward 10 months, I'm still 3 days behind on my life. I've had 287 days to find these 3 days, and I haven't been able to." "I really know that feeling," I told her. No, she said, "you really don't understand. I've always been 3 days behind in my life. It's not just this year. It was last year and the year before that, and all through my 40s and all through my 30s. And as I was listening to my friend, I had this whopping epiphany. And this is what I said to her. "Maybe you were born 3 days too late." "Maybe," she said. "But it's not much of a solution, is it, Robert?"
Don't we all seem to be chasing our tail all the time? That was psychologist Robert Holden from his TED Talk. You are tuned to The Share An Hour with me, Sharon James, just starting on Laguna's KX935. And after giving you the benefits of winging it in last week's Share An Hour, my show tonight is about goals, how we go for them, whether they're worthy maybe, and a little bit about how to achieve them. First, a little more from Robert Holden.
"I think I was born with fast genes. Right from the beginning, I had this desperate urge to get going. Destination addiction. A racing mind chasing something just out there in front of me. Destination addiction is a term I coined to describe a compulsive behavior fueled by an erroneous belief that happiness is somewhere else, over there, at the next stop in your life. And here's what I've learned about that. Until you give up the idea that happiness is somewhere else, you'll never really be happy where you are. Now, you know when you're suffering from destination addiction because you tell yourself and everybody else that you're getting there. How's it going? Your friends ask. I'm getting there, you tell them. Well done, they say. They don't ask you which there or where there is. They just tell you you're doing very, very well. And that seems to be the way of things with destination addiction. So you're always looking for happiness over there. Success is at the end of the rainbow. Enlightenment is in the next meditation, and heaven is in the hereafter. And as a result, we are psychologically absent because we're not here. We're always preoccupied with getting through the day rather than actually being in the day. And we're constantly striving, but we're never arriving. And most of all, we never get to tell our friends, "I've got there." With destination addiction, you're always fast forwarding. You live your life fast, but are you living it well? Sociologists would tell us that we have speeded up our lives. We're doing everything faster than ever before. We're living in a manic society in which the pursuit of happiness has speeded up. And yet, the faster we chase happiness, the longer the chase seems to be.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line, engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up, and long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone, all alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance. Earthquakes of doubt and remorse assail him, impale him with monster truck force. In his mind, he's still driving, still making the grade. She's hoping in time that her memories will fade, cause he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and fighting and riding on his horse. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up, and long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's striving and driving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. Cause he's going the distance.
The philosopher Rollo May said, "It is an ironic habit of human beings to run faster when they're lost." We're doing business at the speed of thought, so to speak, and yet we have no time to stop and think about what our real work is and what our true purpose is. We're so busy chasing success that we rarely have enough time to enjoy our lives, and we're looking for love in all the wrong places.
A reminder here that you're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My topic tonight is goals, and we're hearing from psychologist Robert Holden, who's come up with the phrase destination addiction as a term for an over-eagerness to achieve.
With destination addiction, you're living in the not now. Ever since the beginning of time, the philosophers, the sages, the priests, the ministers, the mystics, the poets have all told us that now is our best chance for happiness. They've all encouraged us to seize this day, to embrace this moment, and to be here now. And for the most part, we completely and utterly agree with them. We really do plan to live in the now very soon. We really are going to live in the now once we've got there. The thing is, we're just waiting for a better now. You see, we can't help but feel that our now isn't quite as interesting as Eckhart Tolle's now, or that our now isn't quite as spiritual as the Dalai Lama's now, or that our now isn't as exciting as Lady Gaga's now. So we're waiting just a little bit to see if there might be a better now that might come along. With destination addiction, we turn now into a stepping stone to get to somewhere else. Every now becomes a passing moment, and if we're not careful, you know, our life's going to pass us by. With destination addiction, we're always trading in here for there, now for what's next. And we are absolutely focused in on that next, to the point that even when we go on a holiday, we're thinking about the next holiday. Everything's about what's coming next. In our career path, it's about the next promotion, or it's the next job. where it's about the next milestone, the next achievement, the next book, the next album, whatever it is. It's always something next, the next zip code, perhaps. And we're so focused on this next that all the while, as I say, our life is passing us by. And we promise ourselves that next year is going to be different. But it isn't, because destination addiction really is an addiction. And all the while, we're like this rolling stone that can't find its satisfaction. We are, if you like, missing out on the joy of slow. There's no slow. No, the time just to be able to take that time truly to enjoy the life as it's actually happening. And as a result, it's all chronos and not kairos. There's no eternal moment for us to enjoy, and we're running out of time. It's also repetitive and compulsive and non-stop. And yet we must stop, because if we don't stop, we're never going to get there.
Chronos, by the way, in Greek mythology, I had to look it up, represented the ravages of time consuming all things, the past consuming the future, the older generation suppressing the next generation. Whereas Kairos, who, depending on the source, was either Cronus's son or his brother, represented the right, critical, or opportune moment. You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's one and only FM public radio station, KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking tonight about goals, analysing what they are, what they could be, how we go about selecting them, and the time we can waste aiming possibly for the wrong ones, or even avoiding the right ones that exist in the present, that are there just waiting for us to grab them right now, and not at some indefinable point in our future. Psychologist Robert Holden, from whose TED talk I've been quoting, offers two ways for us to stop chasing our tails, ray our goals.
There's voluntary stopping and involuntary stopping. A good example of voluntary stopping is what Siddhartha did. Siddhartha had been chasing enlightenment for many, many years. He had walked the path of austerity, of sacrifice, and of suffering and of searching. And after a while, he just stopped. He stopped under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, on a place that became known as the immovable spot. And here, having given up the chase, having let go of the search, he found the enlightenment that he was looking for. That's a really enlightened way to do it. That's a voluntary stop. An involuntary stop, that's something else. That's usually down to a life event. That's something often to do with some sort of a health episode, maybe like a broken toe or a migraine or maybe even a slip disc. A slip disc was what happened to me a few years back. It started as a light pain in the base of my spine, but of course I didn't stop, I just kept going. And that light pain then turned into an ache and eventually something like a bee sting. But I still didn't stop, and I still didn't make an appointment with the doctor. I just kept going until I came to an absolute halt. My back jammed, and I literally wasn't able to move. And actually, for the next 3 months or so, I wasn't even able to walk up the stairs in my own home. So I really couldn't go anywhere, and I really couldn't do anything. After about 3 months, I was issued with a walking stick, which was a great thing. And over the next few weeks, I learned to walk again. And I think I also learned to live again. It was in that time that I asked a friend to design for me my watch. Instead of it saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way around to 12, it just says now, 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 all the way around to now. And right there, in the middle, it says happiness. In those 6 months or so, I found my 3 days. The 3 days that I felt I was always behind on in my life too. And I found them right there. I think we all have to return to now if we really are going to live a life that we truly love. We can have all of the great dreams and the beautiful futures and everything like that waiting there for us in our mind, but this is it. This is where it's happening. A successful life can only ever be the one we're living now. So a happy life also can only ever be the one that we're living now. One of the spiritual practices that really saved my life, I think, was that I started to ask myself how I could cultivate a more lovely relationship with now. And I would ask myself that question over and over again. How could I somehow give now even more of a chance? And I found as I gave now more of a chance, it did become more interesting, it did become more spiritual, and it also became a lot more exciting along the way. So it turns out, I think, that the real destination of our life isn't about getting there, it's about being here. And as for the future, I think we'll enjoy it fully because we decided to be here first and to be here now.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain, though these places have their meaning in people and things. I still can recall, some are dead and some are living. In my life I love them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning, and I think of love as something new. Though I know that I will never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
James Taylor alone on his guitar. The Beatles wrote that song when they were still very young, still in their 20s. You don't have to wait till you're in the later stages of your life to love what's here and now rather than what you think may exist in the future or may have existed. Something to stop and think about when you're considering what success is and setting yourself goals, which is the topic of my share in our tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, here on Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station, KX93.5. In his book entitled Who Are You Really and What Do You Want?, psychologist Chad Helmstetter talks about growing up having learnt not just your mother tongue language, but the language of success or failure. Now, success, as we've probably acknowledged by now, is kind of an amorphous thing, but it's important to us whether we consider ourselves successful, whatever we end up accomplishing, whatever our ultimate goals are. And if we're going to live in the here and now, we need to teach ourselves the language of success. If we are bred with the language of failure, we need to speak differently to ourselves. Helmstetter talks about changing the neural pathways if you only know the language of failure by speaking positively to ourselves, so that the default pathways gradually become the new positive ones and the old ones become obsolete. He says, imagine a fresh field where instead of walking down the existing pathways, you're trampling down new grass at first, but gradually as it gets more and more trampled down, those once new paths become established and you can continuously take those instead of the old ones. And if you do, the old ones will become overgrown and the new ones will just become your go-to paths. But to do that, you have to be rigorous about speaking to yourself in positive language that tells you your course is the right one, that you aren't stupid, that you aren't clumsy, that you aren't fat and ignorant, that you are on the right course. But of course, to speak to yourself in that language, you also need to believe that that's true. So you might have to set yourself some goals to get started down that path. Just make sure they are the kinds of goals that are worth a life, because you only have this one here and now. In this same book, Helmstetter gives some pointers for how to set yourself goals. And he says it's vital to write things down. Step one, of course, is analyzing what it is you really want to achieve so you can make the right conscious choices. And in the process of writing them down, you might get more clarity and see that there are actually other choices that might seem better and you might want them more, and be as specific as you can. So he says the way to write down your goal or goals is always to begin with the word to. For example, if you want to lose weight, you could write, my goal is to lose X pounds in a safe and healthy way. Or my goal is to weigh X. Or my goal is to stop spending time with negative people, or to stop listening to the negative opinions of other people. He says, don't just write, I want peace and love and contentment. Be specific. How do you intend to get there? You could write, I want to clear my debt and have savings, or I want to spend a minimum of 3 hours a week with so-and-so. Be specific about what you're going to do rather than what you hope to feel at the end of it. Attach a specific date to your goal, or at least to the time by which you intend to reach the goal. You can always move the date forward later. Your goals aren't set in stone. Life moves on without us, and sometimes we have to adapt. That doesn't mean we have to just dismiss our goals. We just need to adapt them to the current situation. And it doesn't mean we've stopped committing to the goals either. We might have to just do triage and commit to putting them on hold for 1 day, 3 days, 3 years. We should write that down too. Helmstetter says a good written goal plan has three parts. Number one, the actual written goal. Number two, the obstacles in the way to achieving that goal. And number three, the action steps necessary to take to get to that goal. He gives an example. First, the goal, to take a trip to Thailand. So he writes down in the number one position, his goal is to spend 3 weeks visiting Thailand. In the number two position, obstacles, he writes specifically, I need to find or save the remaining $1,200 of the $3,500 the trip will cost me. That's A of his obstacles. B is, I'm not sure if I'm in the physical shape yet that it might take to travel through the country without a car. And C, I have to find a way to get the time off from work. So the obstacles have been identified. Now he writes a list of the action steps that he'll need to take in order to overcome the obstacles and achieve his goal. He writes, A, I need to make a list of things I no longer need and can sell on the internet. And he dates that by, and he gives it a date. B, I need to call my insurance agent and find out the cash value of my life insurance plan by, and he gives that a date. C, I need to put in overtime at work between now and the time I leave, which I hope to be on a particular date. And then he continues down those action steps. So this is no longer an idea in his head. It's actually now a written plan, a document for himself. And psychologist Chad Helmstetter suggests that actually the action steps are more important than the goal itself, because we're always taught that with enough passion for something, we get to our goals, that what we need is the burning desire. And he says, yeah, the emotional energy created by passion and desire can be so strong that it can get you there or on the way. But you can also trade what you may not have in enough passion for simple, well thought out action steps. After all, those are the things, rather than the burning desire as an idea, that get you to the goal. And many of our goals aren't things we get that excited about. I mean, cleaning out the basement, for instance, isn't a goal that gets you that excited, but it does pay off once it's done in excitement value. Look at what I achieved. I set myself out to organizing all my tools and putting them in places I could find them, and I did it. Look at that. Now life is easier. So the goal, in fact, wasn't the thing. The goal of cleaning out the garage and putting all your tools in places you could find them was so that you could actually not feel anxious when a fix-it job came up that you wouldn't know where something was, and you knew you had 10 of them in the garage, and it would have been a waste to go out to the hardware store and buy more that you would then not know where to find next time. The goal was actually making yourself feel less anxious about something and giving yourself a free path to accomplish what you wanted. As Helmstetter points out, all goals are nothing more than steps to something else. He said he once made this point at a seminar, and somebody stood up and said, "What about graduating from college? Isn't that a goal in itself?" He pointed out, yeah, it was a great goal, but it was nothing more than a step towards a life ahead and everything that was to come. There isn't an earthly goal that's a final goal. Everything's a step to something else. So you could say that success for us all is just getting good at setting those goals that are going to lead us to success, however we define it. Most importantly, though, he says we need to actually schedule our goals, track them, review them on a regular scheduled basis, and get ready to change them or adapt them on a weekly basis. Each goal is just one step along a path, and that path can turn to the right or the left or go backwards or go forwards. Our choice, ultimately. Time being the only factor that will change that. If you believe the old adage that success is where preparation and opportunity meet. You're tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX 935, talking tonight about goals. Should we have them? What should those goals look like? How can we achieve them? Now, this next segment is going to be a bit controversial for some. It involves a man called Dean Tarabarelli, who was an addict, not a more benign kind of destination addict that Robert Holden talked about earlier in the show, but an honest-to-God substance addict. He spent a fortune on rehab facilities, trying to get himself straight, but in the end, it was his own self-talk that got him recovered.
I have this 30-year history with addiction. And during that time, I learned that addiction was a lifelong incurable disease. I heard it thousands of times, and I believed it. And I'm here to tell you that maybe that's not true. Maybe that's not true. Maybe addiction is a call for something else. You know, we often think of the person that's hit rock bottom and homeless people. But at the end of the day, an addiction is when I'm doing something that I don't want to do, and I can't stop doing it regardless of the consequences. So here's how I got so interested in all of this. When I was 12 years old, I'm riding my bike. Next thing I know, I have a joint in my hand. Fast forward 30 years, at the height of my addiction, I had a $200,000 a year drug habit. That went on for, I don't know, 6-7 years. And I can tell you, I could fill a book the size of War and Peace with all the drama, trauma, injuries, accidents, hurts, near-death experiences, hospitalizations, overdoses. But the last 6 or 7 years of this process, I'm in my dark night, which means I don't know what to do, and I'm all alone. And nobody knows because it's shame-based. We hide it. I'm working every day, and I'm doing my stuff, and I'm in this inner hell. And I don't know whether to kill myself or whether I'm going to overdose or whether I'm going to smash my head through a windshield again, but something's going to happen. As I was getting very close to the end of my life, and you know when it's coming, the thing that bothered me the most was that I was not gonna fulfill my purpose. And I didn't even know what it was. But that irked me enough to get to my last treatment experience. So I spent 20 years in treatment, and I've been to every kind of treatment there is for months on end. I've been to doctors and on all kinds of medication and experimental protocols, and I've been to inpatient, outpatient, upatient, downpatient, you name it, I did it. And when that wasn't working, I scoured the globe, talking to shamans, mystics, and clerics, and teachers, and doctors, and anybody that I thought could help. And here's what I came up with. Treatment isn't working. The model of treatment, and I don't mean just inpatient treatment, the way we handle this situation is not working. because I wanted to get well, and I paid very close attention in treatment. When I went to my first treatment experience, I said, tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And I did it right up to the time I got high again. I was watching everybody, and I noticed that I wasn't the only one not getting it. Barely anybody was making it. I'd been to treatment with thousands of people. So I did a little Google because I wanted to just check it out, make sure it wasn't in my head. I Googled the success rate in treatment, which is terrible. At the time when I was doing that, I came up with something called spontaneous remission. That's where people just decide to stop using, and they do. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to be recovered. Recovery is not working for me. I want to be recovered. So while I was Googling, I came up also upon a word, iatrogenesis. Iatrogenesis means death by medicine, and medicine is the third leading cause of death in the United States. That means I go in, I have problem A, and I die of complication B. So staph infection, you know, I get into the hospital to take my appendix out, I get staph and die. That's an iatrogenic response. Medicine, leading cause of death. Holy smokes. So let's go back to treatment for a second. Why isn't it working? Well, one thing I noticed is that treatment and the medical model is pathologizing normal life processes. So the pain, the loss, the grief of life, which we need to grow and process, things of the soul, we now have turned them into diagnosable mental illness followed by a pill. Somebody was sharing with me yesterday, they were watching a commercial of families packing up to move to a new city, and their little son's in the back of the car, and he's waving to his best friend, and oh my God, he's crying, and of course he needs a pill. Not, wow, how's he going to navigate life? How will he deal with that? Loss and change and friends, do I keep in touch? All the questions of life. No, let's medicate him. Here to tell you, I have no qualms with medication, but unfortunately, medication has become a lifestyle. It's no longer an intervention, it's now a lifestyle. And how many times have we heard people say, you know, you'll be on this the rest of your life? The problem with that is side effects. Every medication has a side effect, and some of those side effects are worse than the actual condition that I'm taking the medication for. We hear them on TV. These are fairly drastic side effects, you know, death, heart disease, your head's gonna blow off, you're gonna kill your parents, that kind of stuff. And people say, you know what, I'm hurting. I'll take it anyway, that won't happen to me. But the one side effect that we don't hear about is the side effect of numbness. So I have something in my external world, some condition that's making me unhappy. So I take a pill so I can live with it and not have to manage it. Unfortunately, then I'm numb to other things, love and life and my intuition. I'm disconnected from that. So I take more pills for the numbness because numbness is painful. So I realized in treatment that we were not getting to the core issue, that we were managing symptoms. It's all about symptom management. Anxiety, depression, alcoholism. Bill Wilson, that founder of AA, even said alcoholism is a symptom. It's not the problem. It is a symptom. So we're not getting to the root cause. And I didn't even think I had a root cause. You know, I grew up, my family was kind to me. I was fed. I was cared for, you know, all that. I didn't have the trauma that I heard all these other guys in treatment had. So I thought, I don't have a core issue. But everybody that's doing something that's destructive has a core issue. And what we do is we hide our wounds. We protect them. So if I were standing here and I twisted my ankle, my body would reorganize itself to take weight off of that ankle so it could heal. Something hurts me deeply. I will hide it so people don't inflame it. I'm going to protect it. And eventually it gets relegated to the unconscious mind where I forget about it, but it does not forget about me. So I thought, root cause, we got to get to the root cause. So I'm sitting in treatment. I think to myself, wait a second, I know what to do. I'm going to leave treatment because I have scoured worldwide. I know more about treatment than anybody that I've ever met, including most of the counselors that I've sat with. I've got this gigantic body of wisdom. I am going to go recover, and I am going to develop a program to help other people recover. So, of course, I called my parents, right, and told them my great idea, and they were a little skeptical. So I leave treatment for the last time, and I come to Sedona, and I actually go through this process, and I got well. I recovered. And when I say that, what do I mean by that? Well, 30 years, I would tell you that 90% of my life force, my time, my energy, my thoughts, my money went to using. And I got to tell you, I don't even think about it anymore. It doesn't even cross my mind.
So this man, Dean Tarabarelli, is now promoting his own brand of recovery, and I'm not attempting to endorse him. There is no one-size-fits-all, but his perspective is certainly interesting and has some validity, I think, for some people. Certainly it worked for him. He claims to be recovered. Although surely there is no end in life, everything is ongoing and constantly changing. But I would agree with one thing that he says, that medicine is not always the answer, that for a normally healthy person who's going through a trauma, medication might be superfluous and in certain instances more harmful than beneficial in the long run. And I would try anything and everything before resorting to drugs. If you're normally sane and going through a trauma that's temporarily turning you into a crazy person, just be aware that trauma is a part of life. Grief is always going to enter a life unless you're extremely fortunate. And grief can be a really interesting place. It can actually be a place of wonder. It was for me. And I mentioned this before. I've talked about finding music at a time of grief in my life. Music infused me in a most incredible way, in a way I rather miss. It hasn't had such a force since, but all things do end, for better or worse, grief included. Grief does dissipate, as does joy. Now, there are times when you can't afford to ignore a possible medical remedy. My own father was bipolar. But actually medicine didn't work for him very well. Still, if you have an actual physical or mental medical condition, it is often essential to have a little bit of medication to keep yourself on an even and balanced plane. But for those other times, if you are a normally healthy person, you can learn how to speak to yourself to get yourself on a better path. There are tried and true methods, as you heard about earlier in the show. There's that joke about the guy who went to the psychiatrist. His problem was he kept eating paper, and he tried every possible cure, and the psychiatrist said to him, just stop. Stop eating paper. Sounds easy, and of course it's not, but you have to sometimes give yourself specific goals along with specific dates to meet them by, and earlier in the show there were suggestions for how to do that. That's the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. Goals, what they are or should be or could be, and how to set them to divert us from one bad path, maybe the path of addiction, to a better and more productive use of our lives.
So here's the model. We have a body, a mind, a soul, and a spirit. And these things work together in a very synergistic way. The body, the mind, and the soul, and the spirit are sharing information. They're like a database that shares information. So we have to work on them all if I want to clear any of it. So the body is this colony of cells that every time I have a thought, tells the body how to feel. So if I think about something a lot, I'm instructing my body how to feel. And especially if I have something traumatic that I'm thinking about over and over and over and over again, I'm instructing my body. So then when I forget about it, my body reminds me. You know, I'm on the beach and I'm having a great time and my body goes, oh yeah, you're depressed, remember? Oh yeah, okay. So we have to clear that. We got to clear the cellular memory in the body. We got to detoxify the body. A lot of the food that we're eating is toxic, which means it's laden with chemicals and hormones and antibiotics that my body can't recognize, and it creates inflammation. And inflammation is affecting all of my organs, and they're sending signals to the brain that I am not okay. And I can't perceive those signals, but they are creating this underlying feeling that I'm not all right. There is a ton of now peer-reviewed science about the condition of the gut and conditions like depression and anxiety. Wow, my cells affect how I feel. At the end of the day, our brain needs nutrients and minerals to metabolize and to function well. If I'm not getting them, then my brain is going to begin to falter. So I got to work on the body, and I have to change my relationship with food and the things I put in there. So then we have the mind, body, mind. Most of the time we think about the mind, that's what I'm using to deliver this talk. Actually, that's about 5% of my mind. The other 95% is unconscious. And my unconscious mind is programmed like a computer. So all the programs are running in the background and they make me react. So I watch my parents when I'm growing up and I say, you know, I will never grow up to be like my dad. And of course, what happens? I grow up exactly like my dad because I'm programmed. When I have a situation on my hands, a trauma, I develop a reaction, I devise a strategy to deal with it, then that file's in my brain. The brain's efficient, so it stores things. It says, oh, that happened then, I know what to do, I'm going to react. Most of our lives are actually unconscious reactions. So we got to get to the unconscious part. Cognitive behavioral therapy is great, but it's only dealing with the 5%. I got to get down here. The soul. I've sat with hundreds of people over the years and I say, what's the soul? And they say, you know, it's my essential self, my authentic, truest self. And I say, give me some words to describe that. Invariably, they'll say love and passion and community and contribution. These are all things that sound like luxuries as we're stressed out in the day, but these are basic life necessities. These are important to who we are. An example is young people that'll join gangs. So they join a gang and all of a sudden they have meaning and purpose and they have rules and regulations and structure, all the things they don't have at home. And they'll take massive chances to get in these things and could break the law and go to jail forever, but they do it anyway. It's that important. Another example is people in tragedy, crisis, 9/11 and the hurricanes. People come together. There's no more race or socioeconomic differences. We are at our best, highest in crisis. Why do we have to wait till crisis? And we are disconnected from our authentic nature. We get something called soul sickness. As I was getting ready to die, that was my big issue, that I wasn't going to do what I came here to do. So body, mind, soul, spirit, these are not new concepts, but we have to work on them in a synergistic way. And when we do, we can get out of recovery and actually be recovered. Because for me, being recovered means that I am no longer defined by the past, that I am aligned with my highest purpose, and I can let go of the past. Now I can be defined by who I am becoming and what is possible for me. And I am on my hero's journey.
Or should we powder our noses? Don't live for last year's capers. Oh, give me steel, give me pulses unreal. We'll build a glass asylum with just a hint of mayhem. And we can really begin. He's Savior, Savior, sure. Hear me, I'm graphically yours. Someone to blame us, someone to follow, someone to shame us, some brave Apollo, someone to rule us.
You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. My show tonight is about goals and how to analyze whether the goals that we're pursuing suit us, whether they suit somebody else, and whether they are good goals for a life, for our life. In his book, Now Discover Your Strengths, Marcus Buckingham writes, unfortunately, most of us have little sense of our talents and strengths, much less the ability to build our lives around them. Instead, guided by our teachers, parents, and managers, we become experts in our weaknesses and spend our lives trying to repair these flaws, whilst our strengths lie dormant and neglected. Believe it or not, a lot of us downplay our assets, so people aren't cross with us. We women do it so that men aren't threatened by us or belittled, and women aren't jealous of us and turned off by our ambitions for ourselves. We women often hide behind men, willing to exceed our particular brilliances in return for what we think is a more befitting invisibility. It's only when we get older and become truly invisible that, for many of us, we long for that visibility. Oprah Winfrey once wrote in O magazine that one of her defining moments was when in third grade, a teacher praised a book report she'd written, and she had one of her classmates whisper, "She thinks she's so smart." And she said one of her biggest fears after that was that people would see her as arrogant. And she thinks that in some ways, keeping herself overweight was her way of saying, "See, I really don't think I'm better than you." Basically apologizing for herself, trying to level the field with her associates and family and friends. She says every week her TV studio is filled with women who are so concerned with what others think that they've completely lost themselves and compromised their dreams. And not just women, but also men fall prey to that feeling that they don't actually deserve recognition for their particular talents. The trouble is, what we feel about ourselves, we tend to project onto the world. So when we lack confidence in ourselves, we find the lack of it in other people. And when we mistrust ourselves, we also mistrust other people. And that results in a cynical view of the world instead of an optimistic one. In a way, the more we're comfortable giving credit to ourselves, the more we're going to be comfortable giving it to others. Hopefully a successful life isn't a zero-sum game, but one that benefits more than just us personally. Einstein said, "Try not to become a man of success, but rather a man of value," using man, of course, to mean people, and that, of course, includes women. Psychologist Robert Holden suggests writing your own obituary, which is not a bad idea if you want to see how your goals have shaped up. You're tuned to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, and goals is the topic of my show tonight. And the thing is, it's really hard to achieve goals until we know ourselves well enough to know whether what's a vague idea in our head is actually a suitable goal for us. The philosopher Immanuel Kant said, "We see things not as they are, but as we are," which was very perceptive of him and makes us realize that everything is a perception, ourselves included. But as psychologist Robert Holden points out in his book Success Intelligence, from which I've been quoting, how we perceive ourselves is key to whether we're able to achieve our goals and whether they're ultimately the right goals for us. Holden talks about doing an internship at a BBC radio station when he was in college. Like me, he always loved radio, and he gave this internship his very best. After about 3 weeks, his boss called him in to have a talk. Robert Holden was hoping that he just wanted to give a young man some encouragement. In fact, what his boss did was tell him in no uncertain terms that he had no voice, no talent, and no future in radio. The thing is, was his boss telling the truth, or was it just his opinion? Of course, the way Robert Holden heard it, he thought it was the absolute, unequivocal truth, and he was devastated. To him, it was apparent he had no voice and no talent and no future, apparently. So all of his subsequent soul-searching was essentially, what is the truth about me, and who decides if I have talent or not, and who decides my future anyway? 5 years later, he had his own radio show on the BBC, which was basically informed by somebody else's perception of him. Holden talks about the self-image being your learned self, something you get out of feedback and certain conclusions you've drawn about yourself. But in fact, there is another self, the unconditioned self, Holden calls it, which houses your original potential and your spiritual essence. And he thinks that the learned self is a very poor photocopy of the actual unconditioned self. But to let go of the learned self, you have to re-educate yourself about who you are. Form new neural pathways, as I mentioned earlier. How you see yourself is key to your place in the world and your life story moving forward. You're tuned to The Sharer Now on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking about goals tonight. And many people just have the goal of making money, which isn't terrible, but in itself it's not much of a goal. I mean, what do you want or think your life is going to be with the money is another thing. And of course, we all need money to live. But after that, it's a question of how much money, how many things you feel you need to own to feel content, or whatever it is your goal is to feel in life. money certainly could be a route there. But as Robert Holden mentions in his book Success Intelligence, from which I'm quoting, money's not everything and it's not the answer to everything. He said one of his mentors told him, never underestimate the importance of money, but never overestimate it either. The trouble with the money track is that you can spend your life waiting to get the amount you think you need before you can commit to what you really love and your real purpose. Holden says he's so often heard someone say, as soon as I'm financially secure, I'll do what I really want to do. But it doesn't really work like that, because money in itself can't make you fearless or give you security or give you faith in anything. Some of the things money can buy can maybe give you those things, but again, you have to think what your goal is. Money itself doesn't have any talent or passion or wisdom or give you any guarantee of success in life. It can't prevent unhappiness, as we see all around us all of the time. I don't know if anyone's met anyone with a ton of money who doesn't have the same insecurities the rest of us have, or more so. Obviously, it eases certain things, but really there needs to be a purpose which money finances. And there's no great reason to put off your purpose, not if you're passionate enough about achieving it. Robert Holden, in his book Success Intelligence, suggests that you sit down and think about 5 people who've taught you the most about money, whether positive or negative, and think about how their relationship to money has influenced your own. Sometimes the cost of money can be too high on the value of a life. If your life is all about having and getting more and more and more, rather than giving and being, and if it affects your health, then the cost is too high, right? Particularly once you've reached a certain comfort level. I mean, we're not talking about subsistence level here, but if you're just hanging around waiting until everything is in place, you have enough money to do what you need to do, then you're just wasting a big chunk of life, right? You don't always need a huge amount of money to go do what you want to do. A huge amount of enthusiasm and passion can often push you there. Robert Holden said that at one point he worked for the Body Shop, which Anita Roddick started and for which she got damed by the Queen. He said he had a wonderful time working there. Every meeting was a hive of passion and creativity and contribution. The Body Shop had an ethical vision, made quality products, gave excellent service, made big profits, and still continued to learn and evolve. But it wouldn't have happened if Anita Roddick had waited to start it till she was financially secure and had enough money.
I was a teacher. I travelled, and wherever I travelled, I was usually in arenas not of Western-type civilization, but in areas where indigenous people were, in Western Africa, South Africa, a lot of the Indian Ocean Islands, Pacific Ocean Islands, and everywhere I travelled, I lived in fishing communities, and I picked up the rituals of the body. So when I came back from the travels 10 years later, in my early 30s, I needed to have a livelihood to look after my 2 kids while my husband went for 2 years riding a horse across South America. And women are very good at mixing what they're interested in and what they're talented at and making some sort of livelihood from it. So I decided to open up this little shop, and it's only going to tread water for 2 years, and then we're going off to, I think, Australia to open up a pineapple plantation. Got the money, £4,000, from the miserable Barclays bank manager, who didn't give it to me, actually, probably because I was wearing a Bob Dylan t-shirt and jeans and had my 2 kids destroying his office. Bank managers don't like enthusiasm. So I was going, oh, I've got this great idea, and it's going to be called the Body Shop, and all these knowledgeable ingredients from wise women around the world. Well, the guy, I think, thought I was going to open up Brighton's first sex shop or something. So he didn't give me the money. So Gordon, my husband, came back with me, and I looked like a man. So I wore my pinstriped suit, and we had a profit and loss thing, which we didn't even know what we were doing. And he gave Gordon the £4,000, not me. Gordon handed me the money, and he went off to do his trip. And I opened up this little shop in Brighton. First day, I was in trouble because my shop was between 2 funeral parlours, and they didn't like the coffins passing my shop with the words "The Body Shop" over the side. So they told me to close the name down, to change the name "The Body Shop," which I couldn't do because I just spent £700 doing gold leaf lettering. So I started that 25 products, useless. It was about as big as a table. So what I did was, this is what entrepreneurial thinking is about. I did 5 sizes of everything, so it looked like over 100 products. Smart, eh? Handwritten labels, not so smart, because all the writing ran in the bath when anybody did it. And so we survived. But we had stories. Every product had a story. How I made it, what mistake I made. Don't worry about the black bits or the dirty footprints of the bees. Just scoop it out. You know, lovely anecdotes. Gordon came back. I'd opened up a second shop. And he sort of said, this is interesting. So we came up with this idea of self-finance. We didn't even know the word franchising exists. And my friends were saying, oh, you can do this, I can do this. So just painted the shop green. It was the only color that covered the damp patches. Now it's the color of the environment. And we just had friends and sold to them this alignment of friends. And then we got a bit more professional and set up a franchise system. It was very eccentric because nobody was allowed to be a franchise if they were business orientated, because we wanted teachers, we wanted activists. And I remember we gave them the Marcel Proust questionnaire. You know, how would you like to die? What's your favorite color? What car do you have? We added this one. And what car do you want? So it jumped from a VW Golf to a, you know, Mercedes. We said, we don't like that type. I mean, it was so hokey-pokey, I can't tell you. But what was really brilliant about it was community. And we were learning from the Quakers. We were learning from the cooperative movement. We were learning from the Amishes. We were so excited about the development of the human spirit within the workplace, not just a product. Our real reality, if the truth be known, is we weren't a product-led company. We had great products, thank God, that's when we closed down. It was about campaigning for human rights. That was all we were interested in doing. So we branched out, we had over about 150 shops, and then we made the biggest mistake we ever made. We went onto the stock market. Useless, don't ever do it, don't do it. And we did it for good reason. We wanted to control our manufacturing and have the money to build a manufacturing plant and to control our recycling. And so it was good, you know, it's vertical integration. But you suddenly were measured not by how many jobs you were creating, which was our heartbeat. Oh, we created another 100 jobs this year. It was about how much you were worth. And that changed everything. So we put up these obstacles for being measured by wealth, by making sure every staff member did community service, which we paid them to do. We did the campaigning, but in the end, it was very fascistic. I mean, the fascism in the city is about one very unimaginable bottom line, profit and loss, which does not include human rights or social justice or environmental protection or any of that stuff. It just is unimaginative, and there was no other agenda. So trying to change the language of business, which we started to do really early on in the 90s, was phenomenal. But it didn't stay, unfortunately, because the system changed. We all lost the plot in the progressive business movement. We didn't see what was going on. We were all just saying, aren't we great? Look, Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's, oh yeah, Ben, you've got a great tour. I'm going to do a tour like you, great. Oh, you know, Patagonia, oh great, you've got the best child development center. Oh, I'm going to do one like you. You know, we were sharing best practices, but we weren't keeping an eye on who controls the system.
Psychologist Robert Holden, in his book Success Intelligence, that I'm quoting from on this KX935's The Share An Hour, says, any successful CEO will confirm that you can't finance a business just with money. You also have to finance it with a passionate vision, love of purpose, faith in people, willingness to serve, and desire to make a difference. However, it's interesting to note that when he said that, it was in his book written in 2005, nearly 15 years ago. It's kind of telling of the odd place we're in at the moment, that the money the corporations saved from the recent tax break they just got, for most of the bigger corporations, and I'm quoting from a program played on public radio that had apparently researched this, did not go to increasing the wages of the employees, did not go to producing a cheaper product, did not get dispersed as dividends. According to this report, most of the money saved went to buying back company stock, which simply raises the price of the stock and makes the company look more profitable. It just goes to show that you get in the habit of making ridiculous amounts of money and money becomes king and you just want more. Maybe trickle-down economics did work at some point, but it doesn't seem to be doing the general public much good in the current commercial climate. So where we're headed as an ardent consumer society, goodness knows. The goals of all those original Silicon Valley companies that started off in the vein of Anita Roddick's model seem to have changed, gotten sidelined, seduced by the power of money, the power it confers, and greed and self-preservation. Well, on that note, I have to end. Goals was the topic of my share in our tonight on KX935. And if you want to hear it again, you can do so via podcast on iTunes or at kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. Meantime, this is Sharon James wishing you a great week ahead. Please come back and listen to more discussions, interviews, and a variety of topics every Monday night at 9 p.m.